6 months in Hanover, Germany, living with a German family. And, you know, I started out knowing, like, zero German. I learned a lot really fast, you know, by the time I came back. My German was actually pretty good, but in his family with two kids, there was a 5-year-old boy and a 7-year-old boy. And I'm talking to the 5-year-old boy one time, and he looked at me and he said, "Du hast das genau so kurz gesagt," which means you have said that exactly backwards. Well, he knew a lot more German than I did, but it improved, though. I don't know if I ever got the report straightened out, but you can get around. You know, you can find a meal in the bathroom and a beer, and that sort of what you need to be able to do.
Isn't there a particle accelerator in Hanover?
They turn the V spot guy. V spot maybe.
V spot. Yeah, it's not far from there, but say north. Where's V spot?
It's over there by Frankfurt, just west of Frankfurt.
Well, Frankfurt, way down there. Oh, right. Okay. West of Frankfurt, towards France. So. Mm-hmm. Really?
Oh. I think. Yeah. I know that. I know that.
Seems near Bremen or something. Let's see. What's it called? Debbie. DESY. You know, Google it and see where it is. I don't think it's Hanover, but I don't think it's too far.
Hanover's over the coast, right? On the north.
It's kind of north central.
Okay.
It's not quite on the coast. The nearest town on the coast north is Bremen. And that's a big harbor town. Beautiful old city, Bremen.
I asked Levon, you know, his dad is a particle physicist, actually in Germany.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we taught him a lot about Bessel functions.
Really?
Levon's doing great at the E&M. Using all of this stuff. Let's see. So we were doing the theorem. Actually, it's not exactly like you did this. The first O is, but it ends in an ER instead of an E. So, Goethe and Mitte. So the ER is,
Okay. It's funny how in German, like the R is, if it's the beginning, kind of like, it's like a guttural sound, but at the end, it's like an English accent, yeah.
When I tried to do the Spanish R, I transferred to German. I cannot do that role. I had to teach it. Love to say chocolate. I should clearly love to use it as a Spanish teacher.
What is
it? In high school, I had a Spanish teacher. You know, she could trill her R's so beautifully. She'd go around one by one and have us try and trill our R's in Spanish class. And I'd go, I think in my entire life I've done a Spanish trill once. It was kind of an accident. But yeah, I never got that Spanish role with, you know, it's just sound. But the German R is a more and I can do that okay. Yeah,
French one is more tender role play in between
French. French, you've got to have like double muscles everywhere. You know, just get your double throat right on. Yeah, Germans have no vowels. The French got them all during the war. They won't give them back. Of course, the French have no consonants, so it's kind of a standoff. I don't know. We should be just a little dirt. All right. Have we done the Münter's theorem in the classical mechanics?
No,
I think that's the point where we were.
The last thing we did was
Hamiltonian formulation.
Right.
So let's move to I'm so used to seeing OE. OE. I wonder if it wasn't an O umlaut in German though. Usually when you see an OE, it seems to be an umlaut. Alright, so let's see. What we've got is an action. Let the action be given by the integral sum Lagrangian that depends on x and Sean and the two, integral dt. We could have more than one x here. I haven't had time to work this out, so let's just stick with one set of x's for now. So we could put an index on there for several particles and treat that kind of case as well. Consider a symmetry. Okay, a symmetry of S is a transformation of one, the dynamical variable, in this case, the three components of particle position, and also the parameters. There's only one here. T is the parameter. Remember, when we go to field theory, X becomes our field, T becomes all of the space-time coordinates. So the symbol X for the particle position, don't confuse it with the coordinates X, Y, and Z. I mean, obviously, it's a set of three coordinates, but it's a set of three parameterized coordinates. And that's... It would almost be nice if there was another name for the particle position.
Call it P.
that would avoid a great deal of confusion. Okay, so we can imagine these two types of transformations. And in field theory, we'll see these two types. And our author carefully separates them. When I did gauge theory with you guys last spring, I did not separate them. I treated them the same way. They're called internal symmetries and space-time symmetries. So variations of the parameters are things like Lorentz transformations and boosts, or translations, the Poincaré group. All right, those are transformations of the parameters of a field theory. Things that mix up the field, you know, SU2 rotations of the electron and neutrino into one another. Those fields, that's an internal symmetry. That mixes up the dynamical variables, different fields. Okay, you can have both these happening at once, depending on how you approach your gate theory. It may or may not be important to distinguish these. Maggiore calls this an important distinction. I ignore it. there's the range of viewpoints on how important this distinction is. But you'll certainly see many authors refer to internal symmetries and space-time symmetries. And this is the distinction that's happening there. I'll probably go ahead and try and develop some notation that's parallel to Maggiore's, even though I don't usually do it that way. But the construction I do, as you call it, is a very top-down thing where you start with a group and you break things down to the group and you build space-time itself and the fiber symmetries from some overlying group. Right? Well, that group contains both of these. The group doesn't care about what these are. These emerge as later choices in the procedure. When you take the quotient, you're determining which of your symmetries are space-time, that symmetries that do something on the base manifold, and which are transformations that apply to the field. The internal things, those are the fibers, at least part of the fibers. It depends on how the fiber symmetries act on the coordinates, actually. Okay, so a symmetry is a transformation of the dynamical variables, the parameter T, such that Let's see. Del F is zero. Right? Or how should I say that? That leaves that invariant. It's a transformation. Del F, you know what I mean. Okay, so I do this particular transformation. This is not a general variation of everything in sight by arbitrary functions. It's a variation of some of the things in sight by very particular functions. So it's a certain set of, subset of possible transformations such that S is preserved by the transformation. S does not change by the transformation. And that's independently of whether the equations of motion hold. Okay, this is not something that depends on whether we put a solution X in here or not. For all X of T, not just solution.
Sorry, solutions to the Euler-Lagrange equation?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you can put anything in there. That's kind of what you're...
Yeah, right. This is a functional.
Right.
You give me some function x of t, this gives me a number.
Okay. So if I want to be pedantic, I could say maybe for all x of t that are not maximal solutions or minimal, something like that. Extremal solutions.
Yeah, not...
Okay.
Not just
yeah,
the extremal.
Okay.
It's like speaking French.
You don't process anyway, right?
Alright, let's look at an example. Let's let S be a half m x dot squared. Minus, what kind of potential should we? Let's take a radial potential. That's kind of fun. All right, we know some problems that do that, like, you know, Keplerian orbits or electrostatics or something like that. You know, lots of potentials are just dependent on R. What symmetries does this have? Since R equals R tilde.
But this is our Tilden Square, this is our space. And x dot squared, too many notational things, but x tilde vector dot squared is what? That's d of x tilde vector dt dot d of x tilde vector dt. I say, how can we make this work? How do we make this work? But what happens to velocity under rotation? Okay. As long as these rotations, these are
spatial rotation. Yeah.
They're spatial rotation, so they're global. We're doing a global rotation here. So O is just some constant matrix. Right? It doesn't depend on T or anything. So this is just O I J of D X
I J.
J D T. O fungus O I K of D X K D T. No, sum on I, J, and K. Right? So, how do I know that? The O comes out of the DVT. O doesn't depend on time, so I can pull it out. So, then,
O equals O.
This condition implies O, I, J, O, I, K. That's O, O transpose, right? That's just O. O transpose O.
Zero orthogonal anyway. So,
one.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to be difficult to get.
Right. Okay. Good.
So so we just get x vector dot. Okay. So the kinetic term and the potential term are independent of that rotation, and we have a symmetry. Okay. Let's see. We have any other symmetry? Seems like a
I mean, you have translational symmetry, right? If I just take the whole thing.
Yeah, you could have translational symmetry, but I'm not quite sure what to do with R here. I guess the point is that if I was careful to write V as let's look at translation. So if we imagine having a source for the force, so if the source is at x and the particle at x prime, then V is a function of the magnitude of the distance between two position vectors. So if we imagine translating the whole thing, so we're translating the position of the source as well as the, think of a gravitational source, you've got the sum of the Hamiltonian terms out here, and each is one's at x and one's at x prime. This is going to be independent because x minus x prime under translation is going to go to x minus our translation vector minus x prime minus a equals x minus x prime. Right?
I just think A's cancel off, you know.
A's cancel off, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Then the x dot, is going to go to x minus A quantity dot A's constant, so that's just x dot. So GDT is A of zero, and nothing happens, so it's in various under translations. Let's see, that's 1.6, let's see, what would happen? Hmm. Can we do booze? I don't know if we can do booze. We can do time translation.
Oh, there's no time? Oh. Well, okay.
So if t goes to, you know, t plus t zero or something, then dt goes to dt, and dt is all you ever see anywhere in here, so that's okay. I have to be a little careful with what happens with the limits of integration under that. So, you know, that's a messy one to say exactly what you mean. You can actually get conservation of energy out of that if you're careful. I'm never careful enough in my course, right? I'm not sure. I probably won't choose that as an example. Because you do have to handle those boundary conditions carefully. I have many good markers here today.
I have one that I got from the office, I think, with flu.
Suppose you had a potential that depended on Z, right? Well, then rotations of the XY plane would be invariant. Wouldn't have all rotations like you do with this. But you look at the form of the action and you can decide what symmetries you have. And you hope you find them all. There are some systematic ways to go about it, but we won't get into those. So what do we do with this? What the nuclear theorem tells us is that when we have a symmetry, we have a conservation law. And this is a really cool thing, and it turns out to be really important for modern physics, field theory. Let's see how that comes about. Consider a general variation. Of the action. So we're going to look at del F. All right, this is arbitrary. We're not putting any constraints on what the variation can be or what can happen to F. We're going to have the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the coordinates times the variation of the coordinates. That's the dynamical variable thing. We're going to have the partial of L with respect to the velocity times the variation of the velocity. Some system here. We could have dLdt, delt t. I don't want to mess with that. Let's not mess with that one right now. We can try it.
Be complete.
I'm a little nervous how it's going to come out because you really were doing t1 to t2. I see. Can we vary time and leave the interval the same? Well, not time translation. Not obvious as a symmetry. So, you know, if we have some kind of reparameterization invariance on the same interval, that would be cool. We don't with the classical Lagrangian. You know, if it was the square root of this, that would be good, because then I could reparameterize this time derivative and tell it dxt lambda, d lambda would be just as good as dxt dt, so I could take any lambda of t, just fit the boundary conditions, and then do that variation. That's not the kind we've got. So, but we could imagine some variation in time even. And it'll be paid. I'm not sure how far I'm going to go with that. Let's integrate this by parts in the usual way. So I do want to ask that the variation vanish at the boundary. So we've got the Euler equation del x, Euler Lagrange equation del xi. Let me just get rid of this so I get the theorem right. We'll deal with that later. There's also the integral of the total derivative of what? Well, it came from this term. It's the partial of x l with respect to the velocities times the variation of the coordinates from dt. Okay. Now, do two things. First, let del x be restricted to a symmetry. And require x of t to be a solution to the Euler-Lagrange equation, to the equation of motion. Then, what happens? Everything goes away. Almost. Okay, so we have del f is identically zero. Why?
We're doing
a special limited class of del x's. So we know that class of del x's leaves the action invariant. So that's why del x is identically zero. Then on the right side of the equation, the first term is zero because we demanded that x solve that thing right there equals zero. What we're left with is the integral dt partial L with respect to the velocities del xi. And so a certain integral from t1 to t2 of a certain thing, which is a total derivative, is zero. And we can conclude, all right, we can go ahead and do that integral. That maybe is the easiest way to see it here. Doing the integral, we find that partial of L with respect to the velocities times del x I from t1 to t2 equals zero. Okay, well, that means that this quantity, dl dx I dot del x I, this thing evaluated at t2 has to equal this thing evaluated at t1. And that's a conservation law. It's conservation of what? It's conservation of dl dx I dot del x I, whatever that quantity turns out to be. So we've derived a conserved quantity associated with symmetry. Now, we can do this for each symmetry. Let's do it for each symmetry in our example. Each one is a time translation. I always get falling stuff on time translation. I'm not going to try that without flipping through it a bit first. Questions on the theorem? Right? We just proved the result.
I'm still confused about if if I'm requiring that something is a solution in the equation of motion, then I still don't understand why it's one and not two, because if it's a solution to the equation of motion, then a solution to the equation of motion is...
We did an arbitrary variation. I might have said the variation vanishes at the boundary. I don't want to say that. Del X does not necessarily vanish at the boundary. Okay.
Okay. This is an even more general variation than we have done.
Yeah. This is a more general variation.
Okay. Because that's how he keeps it.
In particular, it means that surface term doesn't necessarily vanish.
Okay. But if
you want to keep that
one, though.
Okay. That's the difference here.
Okay. Okay.
So the original variation is totally arbitrary. We let x of t be a solution, and we let del x be a symmetry transformation.
Okay.
So it's a different choice for the variation.
Okay.
And, you know, what it's easy to see that it doesn't always vanish at the boundary. Let's look in, well, what's the simplest case? The translation problem is. Let's work out our example. So for translation, this is going to be like a data I once looked at. In the first pictures that you've taken today, you'll have, okay, there are three transformations here, and there are three transformations here, and there's seven transformations, and then in the next set of panels, you're going to have six of them carefully analyzed and connected. I did an experiment once. I was analyzing the data on a nutrition vitamin A depletion study, and I was reading the first paper on this, preparing to do the analysis, and I'm reading about the nine prison volunteers on whom they did this depletion study, and when I get to the data section, they're reporting on eight prison volunteers. What happened to the other prisoner?
Oh,
oh my gosh.
So one got away, the others got depleted. This example is not quite as dramatic as that, but it just reminded me. I don't know why I'm giving such a history lesson today. Fun. So, translate. X, if I had to go to X, what did I do, plus or minus, minus X? No particular meaning to the sign. That's my transformation, so, this is my new, what have I called it, X tilde vector, so del X tilde, or del, sorry, del X vector is X tilde minus X is minus A. Why don't we do a positive translation? So, really crazy. Okay, so translation by the constant vector A. Del X is the constant vector A. Sometimes it's convenient to take it infinitesimal. We'll do that when we come to the orthogonal transformations, because that's simpler to analyze. If the action is invariant under infinitesimal transformations, we know from Lie group theory that it's invariant under all rotations, all finite transformations, because we just do a lot of infinitesimal ones. What happens here? What's conserved? So, what do we have? We found it right here. So, we have the partial of L with respect to X dot. Del X I. And in that case, the partial of L with respect to X dot, well, remember our action is for all these examples, we'll take the action I wrote before. I have mx vector dot squared minus v of r. That's where we showed these to hold. And so the partial with respect to x dot is just the momentum, m x vector I dot. Del x is just the constant vector ai, come on, a, or something, no, dot product a. And this holds for all, this is conserved for all a. Well, a is constant. This has to be conserved for all a. Right? Dot product has that sum. Since it's for all a, we see that we have to have mx dot, mxi dot, constant. Conserved momentum. Let's see, something's wrong with this picture. We proved it for a two-particle system. All right. We actually proved something like this plus the kinetic energy of the source. All right, so let's call that like a capital X vector dot squared. Minus the potential, which is a function of little x minus big X magnitude. Okay, that's what we actually proved with translation invariance. We have to translate the source too, so we better have the kinetic energy of the source. So what we get here is both of, we're going to get both these terms. All right, there's, let's see. Yeah. Is it obvious? You're not shouting, yeah. Okay, that's what we said. So the constant, the conserved quantity, is the total momentum. Okay, well, that's obvious. But, better convince you. Yep, let's back up a second. Remember, we proved this for V of X minus X prime. So we should have had the kinetic energy of both the source and the sun and the earth in here. Alright, now, when we do this variation, alright, remember what we're going to do is we're going to restrict to a translation. Alright, so both X and capital X are going to translate. So both of these transform at the same time. Those are not independent variations. Both of them change when we do a translation. And so we're going to have both of these things changing by vector A. And so in our general variation, which will have both of these, we replace both of these by the vector A, right? Because that's the variation of each of them. So a translation changes both the term from the source and the term from the other source. Let's grab it. That should be that image you have in mind. Did that just confuse everybody? Is that clear enough? Joe?
I think I'm seeing the total momentum and everything. I just, I'm wondering, on the line before that, when you vary, you're varying two different objects. I guess I'm confused about what big X and little x are.
Okay, so let me back up and do this. I'm really treating a two-particle system here.
We can call big like X plus B plus A, yeah, X plus B or something, like translated.
What?
We can call big X, like little X, just translated, right? Yeah. Or not. Or is there something else?
Well,
I mean, R
may vary in the solution, right? I mean, it's not, the motion is not a constant R.
Oh, okay.
Right? So that's not always the same. But, okay, so... Joe, I should have been considering this action, where I have two particles that exert a force on one another. So I have the total kinetic energy of the system minus the total potential, but the potential is a function of the distance between the two.
You're missing a square on the first term.
Okay. All right, this is the action I should have been considering.
Okay, I think I'm...
Okay, so now I do a variation of that, and a general variation involves a variation of X and of capital X. So I'm going to have another term like this, partial of L with respect to capital X minus ddt partial L with respect to capital X. This is dot, sorry. Times the variation of capital N.
Okay.
And I'll have another term like this, where I have dl d capital X dot I del capital X I dot.
And we're hoping that last term is...
So, for the case of a translation, these two both happen to be the same constant vector.
Right.
And I can extract that and drop it, since that vector is arbitrary. So I get conservation of total momentum. So if I've got the Earth orbiting the Sun and the whole thing is flying along at 182,000 miles an hour per second, then, you know, nobody cares. It still does an ellipse around the Sun. It does an ellipse relative to the Sun. So you move to center of mass coordinates or something, right? And the center of mass motion doesn't affect...
Okay, so big X is the system, or is big X the Sun?
Big X is the Sun, little X is the Earth.
Okay.
And it's the potential only depends on the distance between them. So if you go to center of mass coordinates, you divide the problem into two pieces. The motion of the center of mass, which is constant, and the motion about the center of mass, which is just the Earth with reduced mass in an elliptical orbit. So you're able to reduce the center of mass, the problem of motion about the center of mass, to a one particle problem. Because of this conservation law, that's actually what lets you do it. Okay.
So you should be writing a Lagrangian of big X dot little x dot t, right?
Yeah, it's a particle. I said this at the beginning that, you know, it has to be a functional of, you know, x and, you know, x dot and t. But I could put another index on there, you know, A equals 1 to N, if
right,
I want to do an N-particle
right,
problem.
Right.
And you just add the kinetic energies and write the potential, whatever it happens to be. So, sorry to get mixed up there. Okay, so we found a conservation law. The total momentum of an isolated system is conserved. That follows from translation invariance. So something that we proved from Newton's law in, an intermediate mechanics class or something, or I don't know where it's first proved, but can be proved as one specific example of Noether's theorem, which associates a conserved quantity with any symmetry.
This x is the x that we're used to, not the parameterized version of x? Or is this the...
which one?
Each
of these could be a function of time. These are dynamical variables. This is positions of two planets relative to an arbitrary origin. Okay, say on Pluto. Which is no longer a planet.
This is a dwarf planet. So.
This is how we're used to seeing it, even though it could be a parameterized version of it. It could be a different type of function that, but these are normal vectors that change with respect to that level.
Yeah, these are just position vectors. I choose some coordinates to change. Mr. Sun is there, and Mr. Earth is there, and here's little x, and that changes with time, and here's capital X, and that changes with time. So they do something. There's some force acting, but the force only depends upon the difference between those two position vectors.
Right. Okay.
The magnitude.
But at the very start of the lecture, you started to make a distinction between parameterized variable X and the internal semitone.
No, the parameter here is T.
Okay, okay, so
T is the parameter.
Like,
only got
like always.
Yeah, that's right. And when we do field theories, this list will be fields, and this list will be X, Y, Z, and T, the coordinates. Okay, so in field theory, this becomes F of some collection of fields. It could be inner, vector, scalar, whatever. They're derivatives with respect to the parameters, and the parameters X, Y, Z, T. So that's the generalization to expect. Okay, pressing on. We lost Jack. Let's see, rotation. So now, X tilde is going to be some rotation matrix times X jet. Here it really helps to just consider infinitesimal transformation. That's sufficient, and it's much easier. So now we have X tilde is Kronecker IJ plus some F1 IJ times XJ, which is XI plus F1 IJ XJ. So the variation of XI is equal to F1 IJ XJ. Where, what do we know about F1? That's just delta IK, using the metric to raise an index here. We know that F1 KJ, not just equal to F1 KL, because the metric is the Kronecker. What has to be true of epsilon for it to be an infinitesimal rotation?
Can't do that much.
Minus epsilon j. Good. I'm raising lowering indices for the Kronecker delta. It doesn't really do anything. But I'll try to stay consistent with the notation nonetheless. Okay, so now the conserve, what's it going to be? We'll figure it out. We have the partial of Lagrangian with respect to X. Whoops, we better be careful. We're rotating everything here, so we also have a del of capital X. It'll be the same. It's a global transformation. Every vector is going to transform the same way. So it doesn't matter whether I'm talking about little X or capital X. They both rotate the same way. Then we have del of little X plus the partial of L with respect to capital X dot, and the variation of capital X. This is conserved. So this is all from Thompson. And
once again, this is the momentum of, let's see, sorry, mxi dot. And that has to be contracted with, all right, now that index is down, so we'll put that one down. Then we have the variation of little x is epsilon I j xj. Then we have the big one, total m, capital M, or the big m, big x dot epsilon I j. Oh, that was right. 10. Big X. J. Everybody with me? Was that in your name?
Yeah, I think so.
You did? Okay. All right, so I'm just substituting into, you know, this is our conserved quantity. So, it takes a nice, simple form, same form all the time. What does this say? So, for all epsilon ij equal minus epsilon ji, we have, let me lower this index and raise that index. So I have epsilon ij, that same thing, xi dot xj, plus capital X I dot X J. Huh. All right. So how can we write a general parameter like this? Let me let epsilon I J. Right. That's an arbitrary anti-symmetric matrix. Here's a clever way in three dimensions to write an arbitrary anti-symmetric matrix. I can write it as a Levi-Civita, ijk, with an arbitrary vector, ak. I might even put that k up, just to be... And then this has to hold for all vectors ak. So, since it's constant and it holds for all vectors ak, I can strip off the ak and get some conserved quantity, which I can write as epsilon ijk. Then I have xi dot xj plus capital xi dot capital xj. So this is constant. This is some constant vector. I'll call it capital M. What is that? What's the first term on the right?
What should we call it? It's a cross product, right?
Okay. That's the cross product of the velocity and the position vector. That's x cross minus x cross t, and then think of minus here, it comes out positive.
You would probably have the m in there as well, so you can see it's p.
Oh, there was, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry. Should I have that? I lost that here. Thanks. Yeah, we had it here. So, we need it. this is, of course, what we would call capital P. So we have big X cross big P. So we have a conserved quantity. The total angular momentum, X cross P plus big X cross big P. There are other ways to write this. This is the total angular momentum of the system. So we have two point masses at two positions. The x cross t is each of those gives the angular momentum about the origin of that. So total angular momentum of an isolated system is conserved. And if we wanted to solve the Kepler problem, the best way you can get a whole lot just from these two things.
Right. From this one, you move to the center of mass system, and that lets you eliminate capital X dot in favor of little x dot. So everything's now in terms of little x dot. You use the conservation of momentum by saying, okay, the initial angular momentum points in the z direction. That's constant. So it always points in the z direction, so I can restrict the motion to the xy plane. And I still have the magnitude of the angular momentum in that plane to use as one more conservation. So the direction of angular momentum gives me two constraints, puts me in a plane. And so I've already got, you know, center mass system and motion in a plane. I've restricted it to two-dimensional motion of one body. And it crunches pretty well from there. Yeah, good examples of the Deere's theorem. I think that's good today. Can we run a bit long today? We're behind.
I'm going to have to leave in about half an hour.
About half an hour? Okay. Let's see. Well, let's try and show this for fields now. I'm going to start with something simpler than the way it was.
Do we always have to have, I mean, the fields I'm sure it's going to be different, but do we always have to have two particles? I guess we do. If we have a source, we have to have, I mean, we could do this without a potential and then just do it for one particle, right?
Well, you could have, you know, suppose your potential is a function of Z and you're talking about the motion of the varicose.
Okay.
Cylindrical symmetry. You've still got one rotation.
Okay.
Yeah, you can do one particle problems. I just chose this because it had a bunch of symmetries. You could do some nice examples. But this is just an example.
Okay.
You can also do n particle systems, you know, spherical collapse of shells or something. And,
okay.
You know, you have rotational symmetry. There. Okay. So, yeah, somebody who knows that. Okay. Field theory. We're going to do the same stuff. At some point, I'm going to want to put in. You were good on the pictures.
Yes.
Did the blue come out all right?
Yeah, it's okay.
Red or green would be any better. I just need to grab some new markers. That's the real upshot of this. Does that one crash?
This is it's a fresh blue one.
Yeah.
I picked it up yesterday because I didn't have one for my
lab. You know. Pitiful blue one. Let's try it. Filter. So now, S is a functional of what? We've got a bunch of fields. We've got usually their first derivatives. Our parameters are now the space-time coordinates. Let's call them x alpha. So this is now the form of our action. And in general, we'll be writing it as the integral of a function of those same variables. Now, keep an open mind about the nature of phi here. Phi could be any collection of fields. Phi looks sort of like a scalar, but you know, it could be a spinner, it could be a vector field like A mu, the vector potential. It could be a gravitational field, G mu nu, right, the metric. So, you know, this could be any fields that we're interested in, and this goes through the same way. So that I index, you know, may range over the 10 components of the metric, independent components are the, four components of the vector field, you know, it's or both at once, even. Right? So, you know, it could run from 1 to 29 and take into account a whole bunch of different kinds of fields. The story here would be the same. It's just how does this function curly L depend on each of those things? Well, probably a sum of different terms, but
A quick notation.
Yes.
Issue. What's the semicolon? Why are you separating our space-time coordinates from?
Because the space-time coordinates are now our parameters. That's replaced T. Right. We're integrating over all four of them. The field, each field is a function of those four parameters. So think of the field like the x before. Think of the x alpha like t before.
But one of those parameters still is t.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's still okay like that?
Yeah. Yeah, one of the parameters is still t, but we've added spatial parameters as well. So these are the coordinates. Those really are coordinates. Right? The dynamical variables are the field. But with that in mind, we do very much the same thing that we did in the classical case. Let's do a general variation. So, delta S. We have the partial of Lagrangian with respect to e to the field times whatever variation of the field. We have the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivative of the field times the variation of the derivative of the field. There are sums here on every repeated index. It could be, let's see, well, there's almost never any direct dependence of the Lagrangian on the coordinates. You know, this is, you know, almost always zero. You know, in a field Lagrangian, you don't want to stick in, you know, coordinate dependence, other than the dependence of the field on the coordinates. You know, it would be really weird to have, you know, like you can imagine, you know, d mu phi times times x t squared. It would be very hard to add stuff that would make that Lagrangian variance. But you know, you don't even want something that is Lorentz invariant like x alpha. That just doesn't happen. So really we're looking at just the field dependence. And then we integrate over all of the parameters, in this case all of the coordinates. All space time, or at least some volume of space time. And this is an arbitrary variation, so we don't throw out the surface terms. We keep the surface terms. And so what we're going to get is our usual variational equation, dLd phi minus partial with respect to the coordinates of partial of L with respect to the derivatives of the phi. Okay, this mu in the partial is a covariant index. A partial in the denominator is actually a contravariant index, so that's a proper Lorentz invariant sum. This is all times del phi phi. Everywhere here we have all of this has a sum on the I. Then we integrated by parts, and in order to do that, we had ddx mu of this whole thing. So this whole thing is going to be what? Right. So we're putting this commutes with the variation. So we write this as d mu of del phi, and then we write that as d mu of this whole thing minus d mu of the first term times del phi. So the thing
that becomes the surface term is the derivative with respect to the derivatives of the field times the variation of the field. And we have the divergence of that thing, d or x.
Okay. Now we do the same thing. We're going to restrict to a symmetry. And we're going to restrict to the field equation. So the field satisfies the Euler Lagrange equation. This term vanishes. Since it's a symmetry, del S is identical to zero.
We summing second term or no?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what gives us stuff like total momentum and total angular momentum. Is that sum? This would be analogous to summing over little x and capital X, in fact, where we have two particles. Now we've got two different fields. So we're gonna have, say, each field may have some electromagnetic current. And the sum of all those currents is conserved. You know, that's the kind of thing we'll get out of this.
So I've got a question about the nature of these, of the second term in each integral. The denominator of the argument, right there, where you're pointing. That's going to be a whole string of things, how I long. This is going to be, is that something that can be solved, or is that going to just...
Let me give you an example. If F has a scalar field, that's a Klein-Gordon field, and a Dirac field. And we've looked at these a little bit before. So suppose we have those two fields. Then the partial of L with respect to the phi I dot, right? What's that? Times del phi I. All right, so it's a sum over all fields. Well, there are two fields here. There's a spinner field and a scalar field. So we're going to have del L del du of the scalar field times the variation of the scalar field plus, this is a sum on I, the variation of L with respect to the derivatives of the spinner field. Times the variation of the spinner field. Since we regard the conjugate as independent of the field, we may also want to write the partial with respect to phi bar times the variation of the phi bar. That's going to be...
Oh, that's it. I'm glad you wrote that because I was envisioning there being a lot of terms that we were differentiating each term with respect to. I was seeing the I's all stack up on each.
In each term, no.
Yeah.
No, they pretty much string out.
Okay.
Yeah. You could have interaction between these. I mean, it's possible that you would have some bar, let's see, what would it be? Let's take a gamma mu, d mu, phi, phi. That's a possible coupling between these two terms. So that probably doesn't occur in nature much, but it's the kind of thing that might. And so these would have derivatives of that too in there. So, you know, this one may have some phi dependence in there if the two fields interact. But, you know,
in practice, these aren't hard derivatives to take. You know, we usually end up with things that are, you know, maybe quartic in the field, but, you know, not worse than that. What do we do? We impose the symmetry. 1 implies del S is identically 0, and 2 implies the field equation here, of the there minus dvx mu, partial L, partial mu, yi. So we get the field equations to be 0, and therefore, I'm not working with a new marker. Thank you, one. Yes. What happened? This is all that's left. J, what do I want to call this? JU. Defined as, no, J, super mu. Defined as partial L with respect to the derivative of field times the variation of field, someone I, is conserved. In the following sense, now, it's not always the case that a symmetry variation leads to Lagrange density invariance. It wasn't all the examples we did, and it will be in most of the examples we'll do. So, in some cases, the action is invariant, but the Lagrangian is not. But when the Lagrange density is invariant, then this quantity in the side here has to be zero. So we get d mu j mu. We get a conserved current in the sense that we have a divergence-free vector field. What we can always say is that j dot n over the surface is zero. And that's what we get from this anyway. So, this really is equivalent to sigma is the boundary of the volume, j mu times the normal to the surface, d3x, that's conserved. Let me see if I can. Yeah, the one we usually want to use is the divergence on the left. There's a conserved quantity. Let's see. Let me call this is a conserved current. A conserved current, we've talked through this before. I'll show it to you one more time here. A conserved current is one whose divergence vanishes. That's the continuity equation. And we can define a conserved charge from J called Q, the integral of the zero component of the current integrated over a spatial hypercircuit. Field theorists, particle physicists, until they know what that means, relativists are careful to put a killing vector in there to tell you which direction time is flowing. So the relativity version of this is valid for, you know, more than sort of, okay, Cartesian coordinates and time. You get careful about, you know, where you put the time. But what happens here is the time rate of change of Q dt of this integral, I can bring the time derivative in 5 because it's a special integral. This j in 5 is a function of the x of n time. So the time derivative, when I bring it in 5 and apply it to j, it becomes a partial derivative with respect to time of the time component of j of x and d, d3x. Right, that's fine, but now I use this formula. If I expand this formula, this is d0 j0 plus the gradient of the spatial component. That has to vanish. So I can replace the time derivative of j naught by the divergence of the spatial j with a minus sign. Divergence of the spatial part of j. And now I can integrate that to the surface. This is now a boundary, a two-dimensional boundary of space-time. Imagine a sphere off at infinity or something. So j dot a normal, outward normal to the two-surface d2x. And if my currents die off at infinity and I take that surface out to infinity, then that integral is zero. Either way, it's a perfectly good result, because what it says is the time rate of change of charge in some volume is equal to minus the integral of the flow of that charge across the bounding surface. So you're free to think of it either way. But we get such a conserved charge for each symmetry.
There's actually a J, right?
Everything's a J. Where?
D mu D.
D mu J mu?
Yeah, right. That's actually a J, right? On this. Looks like a D, sorry.
Oh, this thing. Looks like a D.
Oh, okay. I was confused for a moment. Yeah.
So, again, what you said, in general, the Lagrange density is considered. Where, if the Lagrange density is not considered, but the action is conserved, how far do we get therefore?
Well, quite generally, let's see, what we have is the integral of this, right? So, we have this thing equal zero. So, in general, what we have is the integral of d mu to j mu. Where j mu is the conserved thing.
Okay.
So we can always integrate that to, you know, this is over some four-dimensional volume. We can go to the three-dimensional surface and then j mu contracted with the normal for that free surface is zero. And if we take a space-time picture, so, you know, here's x, y, z, basically, and here's time. Think of our volume as some cylinder like this. So, you know, this is our four-dimensional volume. Then, when we go to the boundary, okay, we can have space-like boundaries at T1 and T2. So, this says that at those boundaries, this is an integral over all of space. J zero d three x at this thing at time t two minus the same thing integral j zero at t one. So that's the top and bottom boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the spatial infinity. So one of the directions is dt, And then we have a two-dimensional spatial boundary, so a d2x. So this is infinity times time, spatial infinity times time. And then the outward normal is a spatial vector dotted with the spatial components of the current integrated over time out here. And all of that got to be there. Okay, so you get the same conclusion from it anyway.
Okay.
If we take the current to vanish out of infinity, then this charge is strictly conserved. So we just get it. Try to wedge that in a whole new place. Okay.
I've got a question about the class thing that you wrote. You've got T2 and T1.
Yeah.
It acts like you're evaluating something. And
so this is T2, this is T1. Right, we're in space-time here.
Okay.
So at time 1, the boundary is an integral over all space at fixed time. At time 2, same thing, different time. So we get the difference between those two integrals. Outer normal is forward in time here, backward there, so we get a minus sign between.
Okay.
Then we have this boundary out here that we're taking out to infinity. So from spatial surface at infinity, integrated over all times here is what gives us this boundary. If this J vanishes off at infinity, then this term goes away.
So if you're putting limits on it, you just integrated infinity times T. So what does that mean?
Oh, spatial infinity. Okay, that's just shorthand to indicate where this surface is way out of spatial infinity. So a large R.
Okay.
The whole time interval. So more specifically here. Right, spatial infinity, and T, anything in the range from T1 to T2. So we're going to integrate over the whole range of T from T1 to T2, and then, so all we're doing is, okay, n dot j v2x is at a given time T is how much is flowing out at that given time T. We integrate that over all times in this region, and we've just added up everything that flowed out between T1 and T2.
Okay. It seems like there are two different dimensions. You've got an integral d3x, and then this last one is an integral
d3x. T is the coordinate, too. It's a triple integral. We have four parameters. We're in space-time, right? So
okay.
Time is just one of our x's, really.
So are they all triple integrals, or is that
last
one that has
different? Okay. We had a four-dimensional integral of a divergence. We can always integrate that to some three-dimensional surface. J mu dotted into the outward normal for that three-dimensional surface. These are four vectors. N is the outward normal. So here, nu is a time-like vector like this. Down here, nu is minus that. Out here, all around here, nu is has zero time component and just some radial outward spatial component. Let me call it r hat. So what I've drawn here as a circle is actually a two-sphere, right, pushed way out to infinity. Hard to draw that way.
So all such integrals will be the same dimension when they're done.
Yeah, they're all three-dimensional integrals. Yeah, whether it's a time in two spaces or it's three spatial things. You know, it's just, what are the boundaries? So you specify the region, and that determines what the boundaries are. I mean, you can make them look a lot worse, of course. Take any four-dimensional volume. It has a three-dimensional boundary. Some parts of that boundary will, you know, have time-like directions, and some will have all the space-like. But they'll all be three-dimensional.
There's a C that's equal to 1 in there somewhere. Two things.
Yeah,
that's
all
C. Okay. Let's see. We should do a bunch of examples of this. So calculate some symmetry. Now, the one thing that I haven't separated out here, and by the way, my variations are a lot easier than what he is, does.
That section was really confusing.
Yeah, you know, if you want me to work through that section and explain what he's doing, I can. You know, his method of variation, you know, he takes a local symmetry and then he lets it vary slowly. Well, what he's doing there is what I'm calling a general variation, right? He's not restricting it to a symmetry variation; it could just be anything, right? So where he talks about the slowly time varying change away from a global transformation, that's just a general variation. So we're just writing that down, and you know he. He keeps it small because, you know, he's going to drop quadratic terms. Well, yeah, we do that. So imagine del phi to be small enough that we can neglect del phi quantity squared or derivatives and stuff like that. So anything second order in del phi, we're going to drop. And then he also divides del phi into two pieces. The change in phi due to a transformation of the field, an internal symmetry, and the change in phi due to some change in the coordinates. We can write that one out. We've got our conserved charge over there, our conserved current here. Let's take a look at how we would break this into those two kinds of variation and get his notation for it. So, what he wants to do is, let's look at the variation of phi in detail.
I have a question before you go into this real quick with the other stuff. We haven't done spatial symmetric stuff. We've only done field symmetry over here. Well, we have a variation of phi. Of I, but we don't have any variations. We said that term goes to zero.
We did both. When we were looking at the transformations of fields under rotation, we found both an orbital angular momentum and an intrinsic spin angular momentum term. That's all
the coordinate variations.
You get both terms. You get both terms. The spin transformation, rotates vectors. Yeah, you get let me point you at the right equation.
Okay. I think I know what you're talking about.
Where you get
the variation of the psi spinners, I think.
Yeah. You know, I went through that on purpose. What you get, okay, for a scalar field. The generator of a rotation is L mu nu. It's X mu partial nu minus X nu partial mu. Okay, that'll get the angular momentum of a scalar field. But when you go to bio fields or a vector field, rotates by a Lorentz transformation, right? Okay, so you've got some vector field B. It's got a rotation like this, independently of what you've done to the coordinates. Right? So look at the rotational part of the Lorentz transformation, look at the infinitesimal generators and all that. So you get that'll be a spin part. That'll assess the spin of the field. You also get the part due to the coordinate change that gives X alpha D alpha D beta minus X beta D alpha. So you get both of these transformations acting on your field.
So somehow the Lorentz transformation is what gives you spin. That's amazing. That's a 2 year.
Oh, not at all. Because remember, Lorentz transformations include rotation.
Okay.
Right. And the reason that this actually reduces to rotations as the conserved quantity is because boosts don't commute with rotation, right? So the boosts don't form a group separately. The rotations do. The rotations form a subgroup. So you don't tend to get a boost conservation law. Energy is not conserved under a boost. Momentum is not conserved under a boost. But they are conserved under rotations often. So Lorentz transformations, you know, they include normal angular momentum as a small part. Not too small part. Half. Okay. So, let's see. There are two kinds of things that can happen here. The change in phi can be due to changes in the coordinates or changes in the field. Let me see just how he writes that down so I can. I'm going to use the same notation. So, yeah, he does several transformations. We did this too. We did several transformations at once. When we did translations, we did all three at once. There may be multiple parameters that label your. So, in the cases we had, you know, del x vector was a vector. Or for rotations, we had del x vector was. Del x I was some. What did we take? Epsilon j k I, some anti-symmetric thing. Which way did I do it? One epsilon. I had an I j x j, and I wrote that as some vector k with epsilon I j k x. Okay, so here are my arbitrary parameters, here are three arbitrary parameters. So we're really handling, in each case, three different parameters at a time. So del phi will always depend on those parameters. We may also have transformations of the coordinates, and those will depend on the coordinates. So the variation in coordinates he takes to be those parameters, which he calls epsilon. So these guys are his epsilon A, and these guys are his epsilon A in the back of the classical case. Times some functions here. So I think he calls these A alpha sub A. So for each parameter, you've got, you know, some coefficient here. This could depend on the coordinates in some arbitrary way, but just matching indices to define some object. So this is how he defines A. Then for the change in phi, there's a term that for each phi, and that he calls F. So this he calls epsilon A, and then you've got F A comma I. That's not a derivative, that's just two different labels. A is telling me which transformation, you know, which direction I've done the translation in, and I is telling me which field I'm transforming in. This also can depend on the four coordinates. So this is the way to make an identification between what we've done. So you could have a field participating in both of these. You know, if you had let's see, if you were dealing with the Lie derivative of the field, for example, of the phi I, remember what we did was to take let me remind myself. we took the variation of the field. It's easier not to write it wrong and then fix it. Let me go back. I remember we did this in the last chapter. So, if cell zero this is phi prime at x minus phi at x. So you get the transformation of the field here, but also he writes this as phi prime, and then he puts this as x prime minus the variation of the coordinates minus phi. So we're using a symmetry transformation of the coordinates to do part of this. Then he does a Taylor series here. So he has phi prime of x prime minus d mu of phi prime times del x mu, first order, minus phi of x. Well, phi prime of x prime is just the transformed version of this. Let me get the phi index on here. So what can happen is the difference between these two is there's going to be some transformation matrix, infinitesimal transformation matrix, typically acting on the phi. There's some kind of transformation of the field. Maybe it's a Lorentz transformation of the vector components, for example. So an example would be lambda mu nu for some vector field phi nu. So that's the kind of thing that happens with this difference. Then for the change of coordinates, we get something that depends on the derivative of the new field del x mu. And we argued, let's see, this is at x prime. Let's see, for the Taylor field, he was able to drop that prime here. And I want to be able to do that. Yeah. This phi prime, this is phi prime of x prime, but notice that phi prime of x prime is, it's going to be, Kronecker ij plus pij of, this is phi j of x plus del x. Oh, shoot. Let me write this bigger. I put myself in the corner. Sorry. So, I want to look at d mu phi I prime of x prime del x mu. And first note that phi I prime of x prime can be written as T I j phi j of x plus del x. Del I j plus T I j. Infinitesimal transformation. And this is, all right, at lowest order, this is phi I of x. Then we have Tij of phi j at, let's just say, if I'm doing a double Taylor series here, I have something like, then the delta term phi I at times the derivative del x and u. Plus higher order terms. So there's the expansion of all of that junk to first order in both the field transformation and the coordinate transformation. But now the T,
what is T?
Is the capital T is the infinitesimal symmetry transformation.
It's just the transformation matrix.
Right.
It could be an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. The infinitesimal part. Keep the infinitesimal part. So lambda here would be some delta mu nu plus some infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, like that. So that example. So the T is the infinitesimal. So I was writing del phi, so I was just writing the first order stuff. But the only point here is that, okay, this phi prime of x prime is already first order. So I can drop this second order, this first order stuff, because multiply by del x makes it second order. That allows me to replace phi prime of x prime in this term by phi of x. So I'm allowed to drop those primes in that term. It's already first order. So you see, we get two terms that he separates out. And so the total variation of phi, you can think of there being two parts, right? You can have in this case, a linear combination of the fields. But he writes it more generally. It could be some function of the fields, in fact. You know, this could depend on phi in some complicated way. Might or might not depend on x. But there's also a variation from the derivatives of phi dependent on the variation in x. So you get both. You'll end up with both. They'll both be proportional to the same parameters. So maybe this will help you read through that section of the book. That's a very complicated section. You know, it's basically correct, but it helps to have a pretty clear idea of what he's doing. And there are much simpler ways to say most of that. But he's being very careful to separate out these things, because he thinks it's really important to separate internal and external symmetries. Well, in a sense it is. If you want to, in particle physics, you're paying attention to intrinsic spin and orbital angular momentum. You want to get both of those in your equation. So you want to carefully track the field changes and the change of the coordinates. It's not difficult to vary those independently. If we are just varying an action by some changes in the field, okay, that's easy. If we're varying the coordinates, okay, well, we know how to do that too. So depending on the particular variation, it may be very simple to identify what these things are. And so the next thing we should do is some examples. Getting the stress energy tensor the wrong way. When you use the Nusser theorem to calculate the stress energy tensor as the conserved charge associated with, it's space time translation invariance, you ultimately get something like a conserved Bohr momentum. The easiest way to find the correct expression for the stress energy tensor that contains that information is by varying the metric. So you write your action with the general metric and the root g and the volume element and all of that. And now you vary the metric and you'll get the right stress energy tensor. And because the metric is the metric, its variation is always the metric, and the stress energy tensor is always the metric. And you're happy, you've got the right thing. It's conserved. Because of general coordinate invariance. When you do it just as a coordinate variation without putting the metric into your action, what happens is you generically will get something that's not the metric. But there's some ambiguity in it. You can add an arbitrary, totally anti-symmetric thing.
without changing the physics any, you know, just for free, if you add the divergence of the totally anti-symmetric thing, the divergence of that automatically vanishes, so you can symmetrize the one you get from the Noether theorem without violating anything. And so you're free to just symmetrize the thing. And then you end up with the same answer. Do you have time for a chance? Yes, no.
I
should have gone 20 minutes
ago. I should have gone a long time ago. Oh. I think I'm just letting go.
Okay, so we can have some examples.
Sure.
Okay. What's the answer to this one? Try. Let's see how this goes. Okay. One thing which Maggiore stresses is that translation will leave all of our actions invariant. And in order to see that and derive the consequences, we need to know how a translation mixes up the relevant field. It doesn't. They're all scalars under translation. So all the f's are zero when we do a translation. You don't mix the components of a vector field when you translate everything, when you translate all your points. So we're really just doing a translation delta x. And we want to find the conserved current associated with that. And I don't want to muck it up, so let me check my notes. Check his notes. Check. Look at the book. I'm going to look at the book. Okay, so for translation, that's a variation of the coordinate. Yeah. Okay. Good. So, x mu prime is going to be x mu plus some epsilon mu. And he writes that, well, let's see, the del x mu is going to be just the epsilon mu. He carefully writes that as some operator. So he puts in x epsilon mu, epsilon mu, delta mu mu. So we can certainly do that. I think what he's trying to do is free up the parameters from the mu index on x. So all right, these are our four parameters, and we've neatly separated them out from their intrinsically parallel nature. We'll see how that comes in. But that's the way he writes it anyway. But then, phi I prime of x is unchanged. What happens is phi I prime of x prime is equal to phi I of x. So transform like a scalar field transform. You move the field and you move the point of evaluation, you get the same number. So all the fields act like that. Then, I don't know, what was our conserved current? Our Ku was the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivative of the field times the variation of phi. And the variation of phi, well, it's probably the del zero thing. Let's see, how do we see that? Okay, so, yeah, we're going to use this. So, del phi is So so nothing's going to happen to the component supply, but it's a delta we need here. So we need to look at phi I prime of x minus phi I of x. And that, so this is equal to phi I prime of x prime minus del x minus phi I of x. And now we expand that in a Taylor series, so we get phi I prime of x prime minus d mu of phi I prime times del x mu minus phi I of x. And then these two are the same because the thing transforms as a scalar, so we don't get any mixing of the fields. So once again, this is the lead derivative. We're doing big dragging here. So the transformation of the field is just what we get from the coordinate d mu of. And now, once again, this is phi I prime at x prime, and I can replace that by phi of x because we're already at first order. So d mu phi I del x. That's our variation. We know what del x mu is, so we can calculate the conserved quantity, or the conserved current. J mu becomes, it's the partial L with respect to, let's see. Well, I guess we just write that. Del L d mu by I. But then del phi I is minus d mu by I del x, del x mu is just as f long mu. This is mu. Then we have epsilon mu here. There. That's the variation. I'm worried I'm missing a term. What did I do? Okay. We need something from the volume element. 3.1. We can get that. Good. Yeah. There's a volume element term too. So, what we have is d4x, all right, d4x prime is going to be observe
that since del sub epsilon is a variation that also changes the coordinates, it doesn't commute with the derivative. Putting all terms, no, that's not the term. Oh, d4x. Computing the Jacobian of the transformation, that's the coordinate transformation. Okay, the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation. There's the coordinate transformation. We want the Jacobian of that coordinate transformation. He gets a factor 1 plus a mu a times the derivative of epsilon. Yeah, right. Oh, okay. So he's thinking of it as a local transformation. If we do a local transformation, so that epsilon mu could be a function of x, then the volume form can change. Okay. Cheating right and left here. You know, I mean, the way to do it is to write a generally coordinate invariant expression and vary the metric. That's the way to get the stress energy tensor. What he's doing is, you know, he's fussing just enough with the volume element to get the right term from the volume element, which is what you would get by varying the determinant of the metric, which we've done before, and you pull out a metric, and he ends up with a metric, and it's the flat space metric, but, you know, you can't vary the flat space metric and get anything but the flat space metric, so, you know, he doesn't want to enter into general coordinate invariance and curvilinear metrics, so he doesn't do that. Okay, so we can do it his way. What we want is the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation, one way or the other. Let's put the prime up here. That may be easier. Then we need the determinant of that matrix. So the volume, you know, d4x, we can think of as a normalized version of epsilon mu alpha beta dx mu dx nu dx alpha dx beta. Not a four form, we'll just do sort of ordinary volume form here. This thing doesn't anti-symmetrize it, but we better think of it as a four form, or it won't go to zero. This is really our volume form. What happens is, you know, we know there's a root minus g sitting here, but if we look at this thing in the new coordinate, let me see the tilde here. So x tilde is this thing. Then d of x tilde is going to be d of x mu plus the exterior derivative of our infinitesimal translation. And that's just the partial nu with the dx. So what we get here is the old volume form. And at first order, let's do it the other way. Dx tilde mu is dx mu d tilde mu dx mu times dx mu. There we go. Instead of expanding infinitesimally, let's use this. Then, when we substitute in, you see we get four sets of partials. Dx tilde mu dx, let's pick some indices, rho, dx tilde nu, dx sigma, dx tilde alpha,
dx tilde theta d. Now, then we have dx rho, dx sigma, dx lambda, which dx tau. And this is epsilon rho sigma lambda tau times the determinant of the Jacobian.
Voila.
So, and then we have our 1 over 4 factorial, and we have all our dx rho through tau out there. So we get the old volume form times this factor. And then, okay, well, we know what that factor is. So we need this determinant. Well, that determinant is what is it? So here's our transformation. X tilde mu is X mu plus epsilon mu. So partial of X tilde mu with respect to X mu is Kronecker mu nu plus d mu epsilon mu. So we need the determinant of this. Well, the first order, it's going to come out linear in that. So, let's see. How do we do it? We need 3 bits from the diagonal. Is that right? Yeah. So we've got the identity plus d0 epsilon 0 1 plus d1 epsilon 1. Okay, on the diagonal it looks like that. Off diagonal it just looks like d0 epsilon 1 or d1 epsilon 0, stuff that all depends on epsilon. So the question is, if we take this term, then the only thing that's going to survive, we've already got something to first order. So the only thing that's going to survive is if we catch 3 ones down the diagonal. So if we start here, then we get the subdeterminant. Well, that involves another thing of order epsilon, so the off-diagonal things aren't going to contribute to that determinant. So we're only going to get the product of these diagonal elements, which looks to me like a divergence. And we only have to figure out what to do with all the integers. Let's see. It's a number.
Let me get there.
It's like 1,
one
plus
k, 1 plus a.
There you go.
BUA, GBU.
Where is it? I lost it.
328, just below 328.
Right. Oh, it's the divergence. Yeah, that's the divergence of del x. Yeah. So,
49.
Yeah, so what we're getting is the product of 1 plus d0 epsilon 0 times 1 plus d1 epsilon 1 and so on. 1 plus d3 epsilon 3. And to first order, that's just 1 plus d mu epsilon mu, the divergence. But this transformation, remember, he's writing as some single parameter with an epsilon AU. So he gets the factor 1 plus his universal parameter with his A thing. Like that.
So we've reproduced his result.
Okay, so all of this just becomes this factor 1 plus epsilon A. A says A mu times D4X times our original D4X. Going back to neglecting point.
So we're neglecting anything second order, is that right?
We're dropping second order.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah, right. Clearly there's higher stuff
right.
here.
Right, okay.
Yeah, everything is in this first order.
I see, okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right, so let's go back to the variation. Let's look at the variation in the action a little more carefully so that we include this term. So we have our action is Lagrangian D4x. The variation of the action. Now, we didn't have this in our original thing, but it's going to be let's write it as S prime minus F. So we have the Lagrangian at phi plus del phi. And then the new volume element is 1 plus epsilon A, right? This is just what we call epsilon U of X. Okay, that times D4X. And now we subtract Lagrangian at phi and D4X, and you see we're going to get one extra term here. So we have the usual variation of the Lagrangian times the 1 d4x. And then we also have the Lagrangian times epsilon a mu all times d4x. I can now factor out the d4x there. Okay, where this is the variation we did before, and that was very ugly epsilon. So we get this extra term because we're doing a coordinate variation. That volume element does change, and now we get the right stress energy tensor. Except it won't be symmetric, but we'll fix that.
What's the other index?
Index.
Index. What's the other index?
Right. That's del x. It was the divergence. Yeah, we had the divergence today.
This should be a divergence.
Yeah, isn't it over here too?
Yeah.
Divergence. Okay. Sorry.
Oh.
Yeah.
So we got to fix the top.
Oh, term. Here. Yeah, where?
Right here, second line. Then go. Batteries.
Okay, there we go.
I hope you have batteries.
Okay. I always have fun trying to figure out, I don't have two of this one. When I flash them back and forth on the screen and trying to get it. Okay, so then what happens is we get Euler Lagrange here. Get the surface term, alright, we get a term that we know looks like a total divergence, and that is the divergence of the partial of L with respect to the derivatives of the field times the variation of the field. And in addition now, we have the Lagrangian density itself times epsilon A d mu of A sub A mu. And all of this is D4X. So there's our first order change. So we're going to take del S identically zero. Euler Lagrange satisfied. And
And that leaves us with, actually, tonight we can serve the current here. The only thing we have to worry about is that derivative thing being on L. How do we fix that? Yeah. Variation of volume part, that's fine. The problem is, alright, you know, we want to write this, we'd like to write this as dmu of something. Right, so, we can probably get away with erasing this. So, what we have is zero is the integral of d mu partial L with respect to d mu phi I del phi I. Well, what was del phi? I just erased the thing. That del phi up there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's that. Where do you go? Quad Lagrangian epsilon A d mu A mu. So all of that be correct. And, okay, here I've got the divergence of something, but here, this is not equal to d mu of L epsilon A. So, how do I get the conserved current? I'm open to ideas here. Let's see, variation of that.
Maybe I'm in part somehow, or.
Uh-huh.
Anybody make parts somehow? Yeah, sure.
We end up with A mu A times L. So he ends up claiming that thing is part of the current. Alright, as well as this. That's not obvious.
His claim is that, I mean, there's the very last thing in this section. This expression is particularly useful when del A of the Lagrangian global is small compared to relevant scale for the current and approximately conserved. I think he's saying this is not conserved.
Oh, okay, so, if it's not a global symmetry, all right, does that help? Let's see. Transformation of the Lagrangian, all right. Now, of but that's what we're getting. But let's see. I'm just wanting to check here. Okay. Wait. I put the C in the wrong place. This is D mu of epsilon A. Right, so he's talking about a local transformation, so he's allowing this epsilon to be a function of the coordinate. Where does A go from? No, A mu of X. And you explicitly depend on X. So, all right, the difference between a global and a local transformation lies in whether the parameters depend on X. Now, I lumped this all together. Let's see. Epsilon. I think it carries some epsilon. So the difference between local and global is whether his epsilon A depends on X. So he's able to make this distinction between local and global by looking at the X dependence of the parameters. So what are we doing? If we're really doing a global transformation, then we don't have derivatives of epsilon A. Epsilon A is constant. So I think I see what's happening. When we do our full general variation, we consider arbitrary epsilon A, so it could be local. So the parameters epsilon can be local. And that means that we change the coordinate. So where do we get this derivative? The question is then why this derivative only depends on derivatives of that coefficient epsilon. What's that? Okay, let's look at our For the present case, this quantity, A, is just our parameters, and there are four parameters, times, that's why it's separating out this delta mu. This is A. So A actually is constant for the translation. He puts all the X dependence, if there is any local dependence, he puts it in the parameters. So we're getting it. So now d mu of epsilon. So of course I've written this all wrong again. We have d mu of epsilon A. This thing is just a Kronecker. Not worried about the interviews, but so I'm just going to correct things again. So my epsilon mu of X is right all the way through, and what I want to do is write this is the divergence of epsilon nu of X times the Kronecker nu mu, where A nu mu is now Kronecker nu mu. Then up here, this volume form is just the divergence of our position-dependent epsilon. any position-dependent epsilon has to do with a local change of coordinates. So we really are looking at general coordinates covariance here. Okay, so I think I've got that one right. That A is now a Kronecker, excuse me. And so what we do is to, I want to integrate this term by parts. So let me fix this. So here we have mu epsilon nu delta nu mu, if we want to put the A in explicitly. Let's write this as d mu. I'm going to drop the index on the parameter and write this as an eta mu nu. So this is the A again, right? These two guys are our A mu. Right, we raise the index, and the Latin A becomes a Greek A because our parameters are based on translation. Okay. So that's going to fix this, because what we can do now is integrate by parts. So integrating by parts, we get minus d mu of L epsilon nu eta mu nu. Total divergence. So this, we get a total divergence term minus d mu L times epsilon. No, that's not quite what I want. Don't take a picture yet.
I'll take a picture of what I was on the board.
Okay. We're going to hold the transformation global and pull that epsilon out. Then the L eta is going to be part of the stress energy tensor together with this. So, you know, at this point, we've pretty much got it. Let's see. The nu in this. This del. Yeah. We pick up a nu here. And then here, we've got, what did we decide? We should have that surface term, d mu of L, eta mu nu, epsilon nu. And that's okay. So if we do a global transformation and pull that out, then we've got the right thing. The only thing I'm not quite getting is, what happens to okay, now this will be all right, because the direct partial dependence of L, okay, L